Blog Talk Radio.
June 14th, 2012. Tonight, we feature a discussion by your host, Paul Grunion, as myself, on the influence of Helena Petrovna Blavatsky and Theosophy on Western occultism and magic. This is a broad subject because Blavatsky's impact on all areas of Western esoteric theory and practice is vast and pervasive. We'll begin with her Egyptian connection with the Brotherhood of Luxor and French Masonry, her mid-19th century connection with American spiritualism, her first opus, Isis Unveiled, which was essentially Hermetic, and the meeting in England with her future Eastern master, Mahatma Murya, Ranbar Singh, moving her Theosophical Society to India under the secret sponsorship of her Mahatmas, her professed Buddhist philosophy, and the development of her universal religion featuring spiritual Darwinism and Aryan Solarism. I will discuss the secret doctrine and the stanzas of Dazian and her anti-biblical and anti-Christian bias. And we'll mention the German offshoots of Theosophy, Rudolf Steiner's Christian Anthroposophy, and the proto-Nazi Ariosophy. The American cults that were influenced by her, the Ballard's I Am, Elizabeth Clare Prophets, Universal Church Triumphant, and the whole New Age movement, actually, and even the Shaver mystery of Richard Sharp Shaver. And we will also discuss the Hermetic reaction to her successes, which resulted in Anna Kingsford's Hermetic Society and the Hermetic Order of the Golden Dawn. So, if you want to glimpse Blavatsky Unveiled, then we said tune in and get theosophized. Well, this is a very, very interesting, deep, and controversial subject. And I'm going to try to present some new and insightful views on this rather than just rehash what you find in Wikipedia. The Wikipedia article is very, very good, by the way. It goes on for 32 pages. You might want to check it out. Now, we're going to try to answer some key questions about Blavatsky and Theosophy. And believe it or not, we're going to be taking a very, very, very positive approach. Now, I came to this position in a strange roundabout way because I want to confess to the beginning here that when I was a kid, 16 years old, 15, 16 years old, I really bit on the Pulp Magazine Shaver mystery that was a kind of an indirect offshoot of Theosophy. It was one of these running serials in Amazing Stories written by Richard Shaver, who was a very imaginative writer, but he was also a bit schizophrenic. And Palmer, his editor, was more of a theosophist, actually, than Shaver was. But Shaver was very much influenced by writers like Abraham Merritt, who were the next thing to be a theosophist. And he was writing what he claimed to be true stories about Lemuria and Atlantis, the survivors of Lemuria and Atlantis with their underground civilization and all this sort of stuff. This was the wild, crazy end of what Theosophy had sort of spawned in the imaginations of science. Well, I won't say science fiction, because actually science fiction wanted to disown Shaver, and they tolerated Merritt because he was literary and he was writing fantasy, but. Anyway, so having bit on this as a 16-year-old and having actually, for a short time, actually believed it, that there were survivors of Atlantis and Lemuria down underground, messing with our minds with ancient brain machines and all this kind of stuff, and having become very embarrassed when my more intellectual friends kind of shamed me out of it. So I kind of got inoculated at an early age by this. This is sort of an inoculation process. So I was suspicious. After that, I was very suspicious. Whenever I heard Atlantis and Lemuria and stuff like this, I would, I'm interested in that. That's not true. Now, so what happened was that when I had my sort of shamanic illness, in 1968, 69, and got into mysticism as a result of this illness I had, hypnotizing myself, and I was, frankly, doing as much studying on Tibetan tantric Buddhism as I was on Western magic at the time, And so I read the whole Evans Wentz series, the summed up Evans Wentz series on Tibetan Buddhism. Now, I didn't know it at the time, but Evans Wentz was a theosophist. But I realized when I got into Theosophy after reading Evans Wentz, and of course having been inoculated when I was a kid with the Shaver thing, I realized that what Blavatsky was talking about didn't seem to have anything to do with the Tibetan Buddhism that Evans Wentz and Lama Sum Dup were talking about. I mean, it just didn't match up at all. And so I just thought, well, all this Theosophy stuff, this is just I bought into the critiques against Blavatsky. I thought that they were valid. I thought that, and of course there were a lot of critiques against Blavatsky. She was roundly and soundly hated by materialistic humanist intellectuals. Just despised her. She was the great boogie woman. and there's a number of reasons for that, which we'll get into. But there I was when I got started in occultism, and I was reading books on Kabbalah and on ceremonial magic, and I had my method that I discovered for conjuration to visible appearance, or rediscovered, and so I just really kind of avoided Theosophy. Even though I was aware that it had a tremendous influence on Western magic. I knew it did, but I just, you know, Blavatsky was just making this stuff up, you know, and all that. That's what I thought. Well, I remember this attitude of mine carried through all the way into founding the OTA and knowing Rigardi. And by the way, Rigardi had tremendous respect for Podesky and sort of Crowley for that matter. But I still felt like, oh, well, you know, I've been reading and studying real Tibetan Buddhism. I got all the way up to about 2 years into doing the OTA. And you know, my friend Stefan Holler visited me, and he's an ardent theosophist and head of a theosophic Gnostic church and everything, and very, very accomplished hermetic adept. And Stefan asked me, he says, well, what do you think of Madame Blavatsky? And I said, I think she did as much to hurt the Western tradition as she did to help it. And Stefan got mad at me. He said, oh, I just won't listen to that. And I said, well, Stefan, you asked me. Well, you know, here's the thing. That years and years and years later, Paul Johnson, K. Paul Johnson, came out with this book I've talked about this before, and in fact, Paul, we discussed this on an earlier program. This book is called The Masters Revealed, Madame Blavatsky and the Myth of the Great White Lodge by K. Paul Johnson. It's produced published by Sunny. That's New York University Press. And the book came out, let's see, when did the book come out here? It came out in 1994, State University of New York, 1994. And this was a very, very well documented account of just who Blavatsky's secret ascended masters, the Mahatmas, who they really were, and what was really behind what she was doing. Very well documented. Now, interestingly enough, Stefan Holler read this book about the same time I was reading it, and Stefan put a very, very detailed and very complimentary review on The Masters Revealed in Gnostica. Gnosis magazine. That's Jay Kinney's magazine at that time. And I was really surprised. I read this review and I thought, my gosh, here's Stefan Holler's ardent theosophist. And he got mad at me for saying that Blavatsky had hurt the Western tradition. But Stefan is promoting this book. And I had read the book and then I realized, hey, Paul Johnson, with this book, did more to help theosophy than anybody's done in I don't know how long. And because what happened as a result of this book is that I took another look at theosophy. I said, what have I been missing here? Wait a minute. These guys, these Mahatmas, these that she said were Tibetans. They really weren't Tibetans, and that's true. And the material they were transmitting and all, it was not Tibetan Buddhism. And that's one of the things that have turned me against Blavatsky. But when I read the book and I realized that who these Mahatmas really were and why she had to put them in Tibet, at their own insistence, by the way, and what was all behind this, I realized that theosophy and Blavatsky and the whole theosophical movement was absolutely genuine in its own context, in its own way, very genuine. But until Paul Johnson's book, I didn't realize that. Now, I don't know how well doctrinaire, dyed-in-the-wool theosophists, how well they received Paul Johnson's book. I know Stefan liked it, and I sure liked it, and it made me realize just how important and how genuine Blavatsky's work really is. And I want to make that clear right from the beginning. And so I strongly recommend, if you have any reservations about the authenticity of Blavatsky's teachings and her visions and all of that, I really recommend you read this book. It's called The Masters Revealed, Madame Blavatsky and the Myth of the Great White Lodge. Now, with that in mind, let's do a quick sort of a rundown on how Helena Blavatsky got started, and who she was, and how she got started, and the story of her very adventurous and exciting life. Now, she was born in the Ukraine, and she was born Helena von Hahn, which, of course, naturally is a part German, part Russian family, part Ukrainian, and she was born in 1831. Now, we're going to kind of keep this date in mind here, because 1831, 4151 puts her about 20 years of age in 51. Now, why is this so important that we realize this? Well, something happened in India in 1857 that is very, very important to the whole theosophical situation. And I want you to keep that in mind. So Helena is growing up, first 10 years, 1831, 41, she's growing up in Russia. Very clairvoyant child from a wealthy, very talented family, very well, a very literate family, and very well connected. And she had, when she was just a little girl, she had imaginary friends, and she had visions and all sorts of things. But she also had a connection with a band of Tibetan Buddhists, or at least they were Mongols that were practicing Tibetan Buddhism, who had somehow migrated all the way into the Ukraine. Now, there were several of these little groups of Tibetan Buddhists. By the way, Tibetan Buddhism is also practiced in Mongolia. And so these Tartars or whatever, there was little enclaves of them. So she had a connection. She had a shaman who visited the family occasionally. And she got this idea from her, and she also, one of her grandmother was grandpa were Rosicrucians, and they had a big library of Rosicrucian Kabbalistic texts and occult books, and she just, even she's a very precocious kid, and she really just dug into all of this, and so she had a kind of a mixed thing here where she was, as a child, she was fascinated with Tibetan Buddhism, and at the same time, she was reading all of this Western occult material, and she was just a kid. Well, now this is something that I'm gonna explain here, that I don't think anybody else has really, really picked up on this too much. But where this great white brotherhood, this great white lodge, the nine unknown men that rule the world, and all this kind of this, where it got started with Blavatsky was this. Because her parents were all into occultism and whatever, and she had a tremendous respect for Masonry, because Masonry was, as you probably recall, at that time, Masonry was the receptacle of Western occultism. They had Rosicrucian Masonic groups. They had Egyptian Masonic groups. And they also had co-Masonic groups where women could join. Now, young Helena, by the time she was about 19 years old or a little bit older maybe, she joined a German Masonic lodge, which was obviously co-Masonic, which was a co-Masonic version of a German offshoot of Masonry called the Order of the Strict Observance. Now, what's really important about that is this. Strict observance, and by the way, there's been some attempts to revive that recently, but strict observance is essentially Blue Lodge Masonry, but it has a remarkable difference. Strict observance, you have to ask to join, of course, but then when you're accepted, they tell you to go out and wait on a street corner, in some dark street corner in the middle of some city after 10 o'clock at night or something like that, and stand on the street corner and wait. And then they come by in a carriage or later on in a limousine, and they take you into the limousine and they blindfold you and they tie you up and they take you somewhere where you don't know where you're going, and then they put you in a chamber with a human skeleton and a few other symbolic relics and a candle, and they give you a paper, and they tell you to write your last will and testament, and they also make you sign a pledge that you will forever obey without question the orders and the commands of a secret master whom you will never know. That is strict observance Masonry. And you can imagine this very impressionable young Russian noblewoman, and just out of her teens, and gets initiated into this thing. Wow. Now, these people, by the way, if you're wondering who started this whole secret chiefs business, where it got started, it's where the secret, it was the strict observance. They're the ones who started this. So let's not blame Blavatsky so much for the idea of pledging yourself to the secret masters. Because, what the heck, you know, a Masonic initiation, by the way, for those of you who haven't had one, a Blue Lodge initiation, this is really, really an effective initiation. You never forget it. And so this is where Blavatsky first got the idea of the secret masters. And so she spent the rest of her life, literally, looking for these masters. She shouldn't be blamed for this idea. And sure enough, she found them, and they found her, because she was a brilliant, brilliant woman, and she had tremendous psychic talent, and she had terrific charisma, and she was so obviously. The members, the adepts of these brotherhoods were certainly going to seek her out, and they did. Now, she went from this adventure. She went down to Egypt, and she had a shipwreck, and she was almost drowned, and then she finally got to Egypt, and then she tried down in Egypt. She tried to start a Jewish Kabbalist in Cairo and a Sufi master, and she learned a lot from them. And she tried to start a group down in Cairo, but that didn't work out too well. Well, spiritualism in America was really going at the time. That was a big thing at the time, and they were, you know, the American Fox sisters and all of them were talking to spirits. So Blavatsky made her way to Europe. Now, by the way, she was married very briefly to an army officer by the name of Blavatsky. She left him very quickly. Just to mention, she didn't do very well with sex. Maybe she had some bad experiences or something or other, but she was really not that interested in filial relations, and that probably gave her a lot of power in the sense of containment. But that reflected all through her life. She was against any kind of sexual expression involved in occultism. But she went to America, and she got involved in the spiritualist movement in New York. And, of course, being a medium, a clairvoyant, and able to produce all kinds of phenomena, she was really she was quite successful at it, but she was primarily she was an occultist, and so she became aware, especially with her psychic ability, she became aware that these entities, that for the most part these mediums were contacting, were either memories of the spirit that were contained in the people that wanted to seek them and the desire, but and also the shells of the in other words, ghost shells, repetitive ghost shells who repeat the same thing over and over again, and just, you know, just a shell of the former entity, the former being. Now, Volansky in Egypt, of course, she had studied ancient Egyptian divisions of the soul and all of this, which of course eventually, you know, it became part of our Hermetic tradition. So you could say that in that sense she was kind of a Greco-Egyptian Hermetic occultist. That was her primary orientation, and she became aware that spiritualism was really not what they thought it was. That these were either elementals, or they were shells of the dead, or they were memory impressions in the Akashic record or something like that. They were not really contacting the true intellectual essence of the spirit, and that was her contention. Well, of course, this put her at odds with the whole spiritualist movement. I mean, the whole spiritualist movement turned against her. But in showing she's honest in this respect, she was really being very honest and being very very sincere, even at the expense of turning the whole spiritualist movement against her. Now, I want to point out that this is similar in a way to Harry Houdini, who himself, when he was just getting started and he was kind of scrabbling around trying to make a buck, he did some seances and some spiritualism, and he came to the same conclusion, except more in a more materialistic sense. He didn't, Houdini was not an occultist, but he became aware that it was phony, so he wanted a campaign to discredit it. Blavatsky wanted a campaign to discredit it from an occult point of view. Now, let's put her at odds with the spiritualist community, and then she came out with a book called Isis Unveiled, great big book, and this was a distillation, well, actually very much influenced by Eliphas Levy, and I might mention Eliphas Levy, and of course interestingly enough, when she had been in Egypt, she contacted a group called the Brotherhood of Luxor, or the Order of Luxor, something to do with the Brotherhood of Luxor. Now, later on, the spiritualist movement moved. They got, in about 5 years later, they claimed to be the Brotherhood of Luxor. Now, whether it's the same brotherhood or not, I don't know, but we haven't answered that question yet. But the Brotherhood of Luxor, you know, there was a... It grew out of spiritualism, but it became a magical fraternity. That's Pascal Beverly Randolph, Van Britten, I forget her first name, Britten, and Pascal Beverly Randolph, and they had this. Brotherhood of Luxor was kind of a mail order course, and this came up before the Golden Dawn, by the way. So, now, whether or not that was the same Brotherhood of Luxor that Blavatsky contacted in Cairo when she was down there, I don't know. However, when she was in New York, she pretty much got on the bad side of the spiritualist, also over in London. Now, she went over in London, and in London, and this was here, this was back in 1851, I believe. It certainly was before 57. That's important. When she got over to London, she met and was just literally blown away by meeting the man who eventually became her sponsor, her, well, I don't really take the term sugar daddy, but it's not a, yeah, well, he was in that sense, Daddy Warbucks himself, the Mahatma Murya. And the Mahatma Murya was, and Bo Johnson has some very, very strong evidence to back this up. The Mahatma Murya was one of the most remarkable men in the modern history of India. He was the Maharaja of Kashmir. And he spoke eight languages fluently. He was a master politician. He was a prodigious scholar. And he was Hindu, actually, but he was a reform Hindu, very eclectic. He had, in Kashmir, he had Muslim subjects, he had Sikh subjects, he had some Christian subjects, he had Hindus, he had a portion of everything. And he managed to keep peace and harmony in Kashmir for, 40, 50 years. He was an absolutely remarkable man. We could do a whole show just on Ranbir Singh, the Mahatma Murya. Ranbir Singh met her in London. He said, basically, "Why don't you come to India, my dear? We have great use for you there." She finally met the master. Oh boy, and he really was. And so she and Henry Alcott Sinnott and her little bunch, they took off under the invitation of the Mahatma Murya, and they sailed for India. Now, this was before the mutiny. This was before the Sepoy mutiny. And I got to explain the Sepoy mutiny for you, because this is very important to the whole business of theosophy. Now, India was pretty much before the Sepoy mutiny. India was controlled, let's not say ruled, but let's say controlled by a British corporation called the East India Company. Now, it was a private corporation in one way, but it actually was very much part of the British government, but it was still a private corporation. And it had its own private army, and it had its own and of course you could go from the British Army and do a detached service to the East India Company, of course, naturally. So it was a pretty cozy relationship. And the British East India Company, by manipulating one Indian prince against another, and by clever trade agreements and clever juxtaposition of allies and all, they managed to pretty much control India. And yet it still wasn't a British, technically it wasn't a British colony. And technically they were really technically not the British government. Well, in 1857, the Indian troops of the East India Company, who were called Sepoys. Some people think that the Russians put them up to this by telling them that their cartridges that they had to bite open in those days, that their cartridges were greased in pig fat, which of course was not kosher for the Muslims or for the Hindus. And so the sepoys and the British East India Company officers were too blasé to really realize how serious this was. Actually, the cartridges were greased in beeswax. They were they weren't really greased in pig fat at all. But the British but the East India Company just wasn't able to quell this rumor. And the result was that all of their troops, the British East India Company's troops, revolted. Almost all of them did, and they started killing every Britisher in India. Well, this was pretty terrible, and it was pretty bloody, and it was awful. And the result was that the British came in, the British Army, the real British Army, the actual British Army, and the British government, and they took over India. And they took all these sepoys and tied them to the mouths of cannons and blew them away. And then, from then on out, they were the rulers of India. And they were, before the sepoy mutiny, they tried to be friendly. And they were even, some of them were even going native, and they were being very tolerant and all that. But afterward, the British became very, very, very arrogant and absolutely, they were not going to put up with any guff from the Indians at all. Now, before the sepoy mutiny, now remember, Blavatsky spent a couple of years in India before the sepoy mutiny. Ranbir Singh, up in Kashmir, which is right next to Tibet, Ranbir Singh had good Tibetan connections. He really, and being a scholar, and all he had connections up in Tibet. And according to what Blavatsky says, and Ranbir Singh was perfectly capable of doing it, that he had her spend some time up in a Tibetan monastery back before the mutiny. And that's very possible. I mean, a lot of people have said, oh, no, she never was in Tibet. No, that's very possible, because he certainly had. The British didn't have any Tibetan connections at all, but Ranbir Singh did. Now, Ranbir Singh sided with the British during the mutiny. And so, because of that, he was able to keep his throne and keep, still be the Maharaja after the mutiny. And he was a British ally and all that. But that was on the surface, and Ranbir Singh was a very, very good politician. But actually, Ranbir Singh, when the British came back and they took over the country, then they started pushing Christianity on the Indians, Hindus and Muslims. They were trying to convert them, and they let all these Christian missionaries in. And if that wasn't bad enough, then what the British did was they gave special preference in civil service. Any civil service job, if you were a Christian convert, Indian, you got special privileges, promotions, and everything else. But if you're a Christian convert. So as a result of this, the resentment against the British, because the Indians, regardless of what religion they belong to, they're very, very religious people. And they really resented this. And Ranbir Singh really resented it. And so secretly, Ranbir Singh was even making little deals with the Russians and one thing or another. And so he was, he had a hidden agenda. And this is the reason why Ranbir Singh bankrolled, and he was one of the richest men in India. This is why he bankrolled the Theosophy, the Blavatsky and her very, very ingenious new religion that actually, and I have to explain kind of how this came about. When Blavatsky came back to India after the mutiny and after the British were in control, Ranbir Singh was still, the ruler of Kashmir. Ranbir Singh invites her back, and he's gonna sponsor the Theosophical Society. So she comes in, and Ranbir Singh himself is a Hindu, all right? A very much a Reform Hindu. Now, there was a Reform Hindu movement getting started in India. And Blavatsky first tried really to get with this Reform Hindu movement because, you know, the Hindu, you understand Hindu religion, Orthodox Hindu religion. You're born in a caste. And you get the untouchables, and then you got the work, you got the soldier class, and you have a business class, and then you have the priest class, the Brahmins, and they're the highest caste. And you're born into this caste, you can't get out of it. And there's no such thing as a convert to Hinduism. In those days, there was not today, of course, Reform Hinduism. I am Hare Krishna, you can be a Hindu if you want to, and whatever. But then you couldn't. And so the Reform Hindus were trying to open Hinduism up. They were also, they had some really, really awful customs where a widow, when a husband died, the widow was not, she couldn't remarry. She had to, and she was even encouraged to throw herself on her husband's funeral pyre, you know. And that was pretty awful. So they were, the Hindus, were, they were trying to reform. But, so Blavatsky first, and tried to see if she could get with this Reformed Hinduism, but she realized that she couldn't possibly, because they still had way too many restrictions, way too many. She wanted a religion, and of course Ranveer Singh went along with this. She wanted a religion that would bring the best of the East to the West, and they would take everybody, regardless of race, creed, color, previous condition of servitude or whatever. This was for everybody. And of course, later on, it didn't work out that way, as we'll find out. But what happened was that she discovered in Ceylon, she discovered a particular sect, a rather small sect, actually, and a rather obscure sect of Buddhism. And this is called, this sect is called Theravada Buddhism. Now, those of you who know about Buddhism, you know that Tibetan Buddhism is the high vehicle, supposedly Mahayana, and then Southeast Asia, they have Hinayana, which is supposedly the low vehicle Buddhism. Well, Theravada Buddhism is technically low vehicle, and not the highest essence of Buddhist philosophy, supposedly, but Theravada Buddhism, and this is the important thing, and this is one of the important things to understand about theosophy. Theravada Buddhism claims to be the original, the oldest and original teachings of Buddhism. That's what they claim. And so this gets them much closer to the Upanishads, And to Vedanta. It gets very close to that because, as you know, Buddhism was its own version of Reformed Hinduism. Actually, when 500 BC, it was a Reformed version of Hinduism. So, this is what Blavatsky glommed onto and thought, "This is it. This is what we can take to the West. We can take this thing all over the world." And this is why, when you Theravada Buddhism and you get into this, this is why it doesn't really look like Tibetan Buddhism. It doesn't, and this has caused all kinds of trouble. Now why? Okay, now remember, Ranveer Singh and his brother-in-law was a Sikh, by the way. That's Kuntumi. Now, Ranveer Singh, I believe Ranveer Singh wrote almost all of the Maurya letters. Kuntumi, Thakkar Singh, maybe he wrote some of the Kuntumi letters, but yeah, it looks like Alcott and sent it. He wrote a few of them too. But Ranveer Singh really was Maurya. He was the big one. He was Daddy Warbucks. He was the one behind all of this. And he wasn't an ascended master, but boy, he was a master. Anyway, when they're getting this thing going, and now you got to understand that Blavatsky was really didn't like Christianity to that much, and she didn't like Judaism that much either. She was kind of anti-biblical. She had, in fact, she even had a magazine called Lucifer, you know what I mean? Not that she wasn't a Satanist, but you know, she just wanted to kind of stick it to him, because Lucifer means the light bringer. It doesn't mean Satan at all. But anyway, here we go with her Theravada Buddhism, which she figures is gonna be the universal religion, which we can do with it. Now, Ron Bergsing is all for that, and he tells her, he said, look, I can't be writing this material for you, and I can't be sponsoring you and all of this if you have me inside India anywhere. You got to take me and my brother-in-law and put us in Tibet. Just say that we're writing you from Tibet, because the British have no way of getting into Tibet. Nobody knows what's up there, at least they don't. And so you move us to Tibet, and we'll help you run the whole thing from Tibet, or supposedly, and actually we'll be right here. Now, Ron Bergsing kind of felt like he had to do this, and the reason is that Lord Cromer, the Viceroy of India at the time, Lord Cromer was like our President George Bush, you know. He was seeing weapons of mass destruction in Tibet, and he thought Agwan Dorjeev, you know, the Russian Lama secret agent Agwan Dorjeev was smuggling Russian guns and Cossacks into Lhasa, and he believed all this stuff. And none of that was happening, but not that the Russians didn't want to, but they hadn't gotten around to it yet. But Lord Cromer thought that Blavatsky, he was having Blavatsky shadowed around India, and he thought she was a Russian agent. And he probably thought, in his paranoid way, he probably thought that it wasn't Ron Bergsing he was worried about. He probably thought Agwan Dorjeev was running her. But as far as I know, she had no connection with Dorjeev at all. But anyway, Ron Bergsing knew that if even with all of his power and all of his wealth and everything else, that if he got Cromer's pundits on him, that he would be in trouble. And so he had Blavatsky move the masters to Tibet. Well, he didn't realize, of course, at the time, what a mess that would be later on, as far as the credibility of the Theosophy would cause a mess. I'm sure he didn't realize that, or he wouldn't have done it, or he would have done something else. But what happened was that Ron Bergsing, who's very eclectic, and is aware that he's very much aware that this is Theravada Buddhism that we're doing here. So consequently, and he's a Hindu, so he's, you know, steeped in the Veda and the Upanishads and all the rest of that. So, and yet this is just not, this is Tibetan Buddhism. Now, what this ended up doing was when finally, we began to discover later on by the 1920s, actually, about 1920s. By that time, Blavatsky passed on and whatever, we began to finally get into Tibet and find out what the Tibetan Buddhism was really like. And it just wasn't anything like Theravada Buddhism. It didn't resemble it very much, and so therefore, and yet, Blavatsky herself. Now, I want to mention a couple things here. Blavatsky based a secret doctrine, her magnum opus, on what she claimed was a very, very, the most ancient book in the world, which he called the Stanzas a Dazian, or Dizan. It can be spelled either way. Dazian or Dizan. And this is a very mysterious book. And she claimed it was written on palm leaves and that she had a copy of it that was so old that it was older than time. I'm going to read you just a little bit of this to give you an idea what it's like. The eternal parents, wrapped in her ever-invisible robes, had slumbered once again for seven eternities. Time was not, for it lay asleep in the infinite bosom of duration. Universal mind was not, for there were no Ahi to contain it. The seven ways to bliss were not. The great causes of misery were not, for there was no one to produce and get ensnared by them. Darkness alone fueled the boundless all, for father, mother, and son were once more one, and the son had not awakened yet for the new wheel and his pilgrimage thereon. And the seven sublime lords and the seven truths had ceased to be, and the universe and the sun of necessity was immersed in pranaspana, to be outbreathed by that which is and yet is not, and what was. And the causes of existence had been done away with, and the visible that was and the invisible that is rested in eternal non-being, the one being. Now, that'll give you an idea of the cryptic nature of the stanzas of Dizan. Now, people poo-pooed this thing, critics poo-pooed this thing. Oh, gosh, this is something she made up and a whole bunch of stuff. Actually, it turns out that it really is part of a very old Tibetan book. And and he could have very, very easily run across it in the Shaanxi Library of the Monastery where Murya sent her back before the mutiny. That's quite possible. There again, and that's, it's just probably valid. Now, the business with the Tibetan venue of Murya and Kundumi, where this turned out to be a bad thing was later on when after Lord Cromer, remember paranoid Lord Cromer, he got convinced by 1903, he was thoroughly convinced that there were Cossacks and there were Russian munitions and there were Cossacks swarming into Lhasa, and he was just convinced of it. So he mounted an expedition led by Sir Francis Younghusband, and they marched all the way up into Tibet and wiped out the Tibetan army at one engagement. That was kind of pathetic. These poor old Tibetans with their muskets and up against machine guns. And then they marched into Lhasa. Meanwhile, the Dalai Lama had decamped for Mongolia. And so the British opened up Tibet. Oh, boy. Well, of course, Sir Francis Younghusband, the British Special Forces officer that led that expedition, he took some time and went up in a mountain and meditated and got in contact with some aliens from another planet. And then when he retired, he started the first alien UFO free love cult in London, so I guess I suppose something good came out of it, but anyway, that opened up Tibet. So then we began to find out what Tibetan Buddhism really was like. Now, so by the 1920s, and remember now, the main up through the 1920s until the Chinese kicked the Buddhists out of Tibet, The main thing we had was the Evans-Wentz series from Oxford Books, and that was Ramadan was summed up, and Evans-Wentz was a theosophist, and summed up the Lama. He backed Blavatsky up, and here was all of this. Yeah, sure. Theravada Buddhism wasn't Tibetan Buddhism, but doggone it, it was Buddhism. And Blavatsky, you know, her cosmology is perfectly valid. And so anyway, what the result of all of this was that we had channelers like Alice Bailey and all that are endlessly contacting Tibetan masters who are not Tibetan. And that, you know, that didn't do any good either. So, and I'm not saying Alice Bailey is all, but still, I mean, now we know the why of the whole thing. We don't have to try to pass off Blavatsky's original writings as Tibetan. We don't need to do that anymore. But this hurt. It intended to discredit theosophy. Now, theosophy today, it's still going strong. I mean, it's holding on. They have about 5,000 members in this country, and they have about 14,000-15,000 in India. And they have them all around the world, and they publish a lot of books. And by the way, as I said, the theosophic theories and the cosmology and these vast cycles and vast evolutions, all of this has had a tremendous influence on a lot of cultures. You can't get away from it. It's kind of, you know, one of the things that made theosophy, gave it an appeal, and I mentioned Darwin in the abstract, is, you know, Darwin's theory of evolution sort of really threw a blow at fundamental biblical Judaism and Christianity. It's just really it. Well, what Blavatsky came up with was a super spiritual evolution from super ancient Atlantis and Lemuria and rude races that were all the way up from the pre-human and all of this, and it was in these vast cosmic cycles, and this gave an evolution of the spirit. So it gave evolution back to religion. In other words, it was kind of Darwinian. It was a Darwinian religion, whereas biblical special creation had been discredited by Darwin. So that was the Darwinian influence. And also, too, I want to point out that Albert Pike and Manly Hall and Blavatsky all shared a common idea that way back in prehistory, there was a magnificent monotheistic religion. And, of course, in Blavatsky's case, it was Buddhism, so there is no God. There is only a great universal principle. But regardless of that, there's this one great principle religion that devolved and fragmented as history went on. So you had a devolution of spirituality, and they all felt that they could, these great magicians of the 19th century, Albert Pike and Blavatsky and as I later on, Manly Hall, they all believed in this original vision. Now, next week, going right along with this, next week we're going to discuss the dark side of theosophy, or the dark spin-offs of theosophy, and we're going to discuss the Ariosophy the German Ariosophy of Edel von List and Liebenfels and the Thule group and that bunch and the the Reich of the Black Sun. So next week, get ready to shine your boots and go on the dark side. So meanwhile, good magic.